9 a.m. on a Tuesday morning, and the beautiful thing about your day is that it is KOWA that you're listening to. This is 106.5 KOWA low power FM in Olympia, Washington, and we are the Bad Folk Orchestra. We're going to perform the Wage Slave Hustle for you, and that means we're going to read some things, we're going to sing some things, and we might do a little bit of extemporaneous random stuff, like I'm doing right now, this introduction thing. It's extemporaneous.
Woohoo!
We like extemporaneity, or however you would conjugate that.
Extemporaneousness.
Yes. Yes, extemporaneousness. That's our favorite thing in the world. Today, the crew that we're bringing forward for you is we've got a young lady named Charlotte, and she plays a banjo. We've got a young man named Doc, and Doc is our engineer who is constantly forced to deal with the random extemporaneity of our foolishness in this place. Yes, ma'am. We've got Charlotte on the banjo. We've got Drew.
Let's not comment.
Drew's going to read some things for us.
Somewhat.
Let's not comment about me.
Doc, who feels free to comment, doesn't want us to comment about him, which is what we call democracy sometimes here at the Wage Slave Hustle. If you happen to be doing the Wage Slave Hustle out there in listener land, you might be familiar with the people who control your lives having double standards. But let's move on from there before everything goes horribly wrong. And then we've got Caitlin.
Hola.
On the guitar. And we've got Timothy, who's going to be reading a little bit with us. Perhaps singing along in the background. And I'm an invisible pirate, and I love you. I really do. In this really vague, sort of unconditional way. You know, same way I love my mom and homeless people all at the same time. But that's not what we're talking about right now. What we're talking about right now is the next song we're going to do. And it is the KOWA theme song. In the key of F sharp. That's our sound check and our audio, station identification. That's the word for it.
Clip out.
What's that?
Clip out.
Clip out. Yeah, that's it. It's our clip out. And life is beautiful. And now we're going to slip right into the feature of the Wage Slave Hustle that is the most exciting and the most beautiful is the stories of Henrietta Lawson. Henrietta is an old traveling companion of mine, and as we related last week, she's no longer in this material realm in the way that, you know, you and I are, because you can hear me and I can speak, and so that means we're alive. Well, she's not. But she wrote these stories, and so we're going to bring her to life in this impossible sort of way. That's our little goal, and yes, what we're performing is Tales from Cafe Queequeg. And the Tales from Cafe Queequeg are 3 stories and 14 songs that sort of reflect the memory of her face. The middle part of the Tales from Cafe Queequeg is a little thing called Addiction, which is a collection of 6 songs, one in the key of E, one in A, one in D, one in G, one in B, and one in E, which are the 6 strings on the guitar, which I remember as every acid dealer gets busted eventually. But, you know, that's just me. And that's a little lesson to you kids out there. Be careful.
Sound like Beetlejuice.
Yeah, careful. We don't want to say things that we might have to pay for.
Oh, I always drink Beetlejuice.
Beetlejuice. It's yummy, and it tastes just like my nose.
Welcome to the Wage Slave Hustle. We're about to perform the first two songs of the Addiction Cycle, which in the course of Tales from Cafe Queequeg, it actually happened in the middle of the book. And that's why we're doing it at the beginning, because it's like one of them Fibonacci sequences, you know, all the snail shell expands and everything's perfect and growing.
Math.
We're going to do some math here for you, some math about crows that eat cigarette butts.
Life math.
We're going to start with E, seven generations wrong, and then we're going to do A, the blind cat. Slave Hustle's Addiction, The Tragedy of Jim Crow by Henrietta Lawson. And the second song continues the story a little bit. If you happen to follow the story that happened in the first one, here's a little bit more about our friend Jim, who's not really a crow.
Treasure, but the yard it was guarded by an Asian mountain cat.
as his khaki on his buddies. You followed that Jim plucked. Pecked him out. Pecked the eyes of that poor cat out. Oh, man. And then they collected the cigarette butts. And if you've ever heard the sound of a cat losing a fight to a bird.
And if you've ever collected cigarette butts.
You know what that story's all about. If those things haven't happened to you, then, you know, this is kind of like for white people living today thinking about segregation as it used to exist in this country. Which is why I wrote this story, so that maybe you'd start to think about subject matter that might be confusing to you, but you should probably get involved in. All right. So, the next thing we're going to do is...
Charlotte?
I don't know. What are we
there
doing?
There was a bunch of baby spiders over there yesterday. They're so adorable.
Oh, yeah. Love baby you know, spiders. It's springtime. Things are coming to life.
There was about 80 of them. So they were so freaking cute. And they were like, meep, going down their little webs. And I was like, have you ever seen Charlotte's
web?
Oh.
Yeah, I've seen it.
There you go.
The spiders.
That's what it was like. It was adorable. And nobody wanted to kill them, which is what usually happens with baby spiders. Thank goodness it didn't happen this time.
They're tasty.
Mmm.
Because no one likes mosquitoes, and no one likes flies.
The good news about baby spiders is that they mean that another generation is coming along. And that's exciting to me. And it also means that things are going to die. And get eaten, you know. And I like that. But they're also pretty. It's like, what do you call it? Fractals.
Yeah.
It's just like fractals, watching them expand. They run around in their little Fibonacci sequences, blowing up, and... Oh, I love it.
Blowing up.
Well, yeah, they will go, like, you know, blowing on the wind. You know, like, they throw out their... Like,
they
parachute. Yeah, they spin their silk. Yeah, that's what they do, spin silk. Yeah, and then they fly away.
What a life to live.
And they fly to a new tree.
You know, it's not like babies in, like, our lives. Like, our babies, they're born.
Yeah, they're on themselves and
yeah.
All these nasty
carried around, things. Sucking on titties and things like that, you know. And
looking cute and getting love.
All the beauty that goes along with such adventures. But the reality is the baby spiders, their life begins... With creation, you know, like, they get to make stuff right away, and their turds, like, no one has to clean them up. In fact, they use their feces, or whatever it is that's silk coming out of a spider's
butt. Yeah,
what's
up with these humans,
yeah.
Man?
Come out of spit
and they
rats.
Fly away. Yeah. You know, it's beautiful.
Okay. That's happening now, I think.
This one? Or that one?
I think. With song one. Morning, when this life is over, I will fly away to a home on God's celestial shore.
I'm
So that was an extemporaneous cover of a very, very old song. We try to do on this radio program nothing that anyone has ever put out and asked for money for. Because we believe in the public domain. Anything you ever hear on this show is in the public domain. It's completely open for you to use any other way you desire to do so. Our goal as the Bad Folk Orchestra is to do something we call the Babylon Refugee Rescue Operation. Or bro, for short, you know. And so bro's purpose is to take media and turn it into a farm that is a school for midwifery. That's right. We're singing a farm that is a school for midwifery into existence right now. That's our goal. That's our desire. If you're out there in listener land, that's great. If there's nobody out there right now, we're recording it. And there's a chance that perhaps we'll do our best to make it happen. Yeah, that's right. All of this was inspired by our good friend, Henrietta Lawson, before she stopped living in this world and started doing other things. God only knows, well, if there is one. And on the way into that, I'd now like to introduce the genesis of Cubist prosody, which is going to be performed by our friend Charlotte. But it was something that Henrietta wrote for us. And Charlotte's going to step in for Henrietta today, seeing as she can't be here in the flesh.
All right. How am I? Aroha, aroha, aroha nui. In the beginning, there was your mom. Word. Relax. You and I are the same. We are alive. Were this not so, I could not transmit this message, nor could you receive it. This message will not self-destruct. In fact, it has seemingly impossible mission to become self-replicating. Just like you and me, how is this going to happen? Love. Self-replicating. These stories and the songs that enliven them are a little thing I like to call Cubist prosody. They have one purpose, which may or may not involve your own personal entertainment. In 1999, I set myself a goal to create documents that would, of their own merit, flower into a school for midwifery, an advanced obstetrics. It should be a non-profit school on a farm. Homeless and dispossessed pregnant women should be allowed to come there and be taken care of. Their stay should be allowed to continue until they are done nursing their child. In that postpartum period, their stay would be reckoned as barter, either in learning to take part in midwifery or in helping to operate the institution and farm. Lastly, all major decisions about the farm, the state of the farm, would be brought before the pregnant women in council. In them would be rest all decision-making authority. A crazy experiment? Maybe. How do we get from here to there? Well, first a bit of gossip. One girl telling another about a conversation she had with a boy she liked. Actually, she's telling the boy about the conversation that she had with girl. From the point of view of the story that unfolds, this song gets sung at the very end.
Those are all just evidence of facts.
back. For the love of Pete, I tell you it's true. Jesus was what punk rock the new.
Everybody's hiding from themselves.
Blending in is the biggest sin, but my brother stood up on the mountain and he shouted,
We'll all be refugees
until the last of us is out of jail.
We will all be refugees.
We will all be refugees.
Mothers.
We've only got all the time in the world. I've learned in that terrain that is pretty tight limit. There's not much time.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Henrietta Lawson. Thank you very much, Charlotte, for performing for us. Thank you very much, Drew, for speaking the voice of John, because he's going to be doing that all morning long. But before we get to the point where we're reading the first short story in the collection, which we're going to do, the first section of it. The first short story in the collection, Tales from Cafe Queequeg, is called Are Not the Fallen Saints the Least of All People? And today we're going to be reading Part A, Are Not the Fallen. But before we get to that, we're going to tell you where we are, and we're going to tell you who we are. We're the Bad Folk Orchestra. And I used to be a hobo. I was never alone. I sleep in a house now I feel so almost like the new day of the road. I slept under more bridges than most folks ever cross. I wept for joy and well, I wept for things I lost. I'm doing that wage slave hustle, doing that wage slave hustle, baby, doing that wage slave hustle. That wage slave hustle is doing me. I was once cast away by myself out at sea, following the wind's snow so far I could see, all the way to the end, all the way to the end, following the wind's snow so far I could see, all the way to the end. Doing that wage slave hustle, doing that wage slave hustle, baby. So this is the Wage Slave Hustle. That's our program. And that there song, that's a true story that I have slept under more bridges than most folks ever cross. I was born in 1975, right around the time the Vietnam War ended. And the reality is that in the time of my life, I've encountered quite a lot of people who sleep under bridges. Because I've done quite a lot of that. I've hopped some trains. I've hitchhiked quite a large number of miles. I've eaten and soup kitchens in almost every single major city in this country, and almost probably all of the small college towns. And the reality that I find when I get to those soup kitchens and under those bridges is that there's a whole lot of people who eat there who gave their all, everything they had, which included for some of them their sanity and some of their limbs, and for quite a lot of them their lives. I didn't meet the ones who had cost their lives, but for quite a lot of them it's true. A lot of our veterans are mistreated in this country. And that's a sad truth. That's a sad fact. Yesterday was Memorial Day. And I just sort of want to give props out there to all the vets. I want to say thanks to all those who passed away. I want to say thanks to all those who are currently alive today. And for all those people who sit comfortably in America, enjoying the freedoms provided by those individuals. Whether or not you're a pacifist or whatever you might be, whether or not you agree with whether or not there is a war, if you have an empty room in your house and there is a homeless vet outside, you have a house because of that vet, not because of some stuff you did, not because of your wage slave hustling. I'm proud of you. I'm happy for you. But you'd be living under a totalitarian regime were it not for those vets fighting for you. You would have no right to listen to me were it not for those vets. And so I want to give mad props to those vets out there. I'm a pacifist. I disagree wholeheartedly with war. I think it's way wrong. But I have the right to feel that way because of what those vets did. And that's the sort of contradiction that that I live in this world today. And that's sort of that's why we do a radio show. Sort of to bring up these contradictions and ask people about how they feel about it. And I'm getting a little bit verklempt here, as they say, in bad Yiddish circles.
Well, thank you anyway, Owen. On behalf of the resident vet here at Media Island International and KOWA, you've touched my heart there, baby.
Well, that's good. You know, anytime I can use my tongue to touch anybody, I feel pretty good about myself. Regardless.
Well, I didn't mean it that way.
Oh, I know. But hey, baby.
But thank you. But thank you from the bottom of my heart, and from the veterans that are not here. I thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, no problem, brother. I love you. Thank you very much. They turned me down when I was 18 because I have asthma. And so they said they didn't want me on the front lines. They couldn't have me, and so I picked up a guitar instead.
You could have been on a magazine cover.
Yeah. Maybe sometime soon we'll do things well enough that some vet out there is going to have his magazine on his hip the way he's supposed to, and he's going to take a picture of us and put us on his magazine cover. But that's the only magazine cover I want to be on, personally. But we'll see what happens. I want to stay poor. That's why I'm making music. Could go wrong. Who knows? Anyways, this is in the key of G. No, we're going to do it in C. Yeah.
Modulation down. 6.5. Oh, baby.
106.5
KFWA.
In the key of C.
Someone tried to steal my frequency modulation.
All the words in the English language are available to you today because this is in the public domain. If you don't know what the public domain is as it relates to intellectual property and you live in this country today, I recommend that you go get the dictionary or Google it, because the public domain is yours, and you can use it however you want, and all of the things done by the Babylon Refugee Rescue Operation are in the public domain. If you don't know what that is, please, go look it up.
And you're ignorant under that rock.
Yeah. Your ignorance is going to destroy you. That's a fundamental fact of reality. And before your ignorance destroys you, we've decided what we're going to do is we're going to read you a little story. A little story called Are Not the Fallen Saints the Least of All People? Part A, Are Not the Fallen. This was written by Henrietta Lawson, an old traveling companion of mine, before she threw herself under a train. She said it wasn't a world worth living in. That's why I'm kind of intense sometimes, is I've been through things like that. If you haven't been through things like that, you know, if you're working as an espresso jerk or some random thing, the good news is this story, if you're a Christian Sound guy, if you happen to be, you know, a vet, because we're going to talk about all these different types of people in this little story we're about to read. As it was written by our good friend Henrietta Lawson, Part A, Are Not the Fallen. The shopkeeper turned to the security guard and said,
"Okay, so you're in a position of authority now. You can't just go acting aggressively from speculation. You got to start with communication and work towards confirmation. First things first."
"Neither you nor I are characters in the story I am about to tell. We can't be. We're not in Paramus, New Jersey. I've never even been there. Right now, three people sit at a table outside the mall. Two are employed there. The third is a random transient whom they found re-rolling cigarettes from the ashtrays. One of the two is mall security, the other managing partner of a cafe. They are female and male, respectively. The transient is also female, somewhere in her mid-twenties. They do not know it, but their meeting here is not random chance. Rather, it is a form of geometry. It is, of course, an accepted principle that two truly parallel lines will never intersect. They may appear, through convolutions of perspective, to do so, to overlap even. The reality is that each stretches on infinitely, ever separate and distinct. And so, these three folks are, right now, involved in the unlikely process of bringing the influence of one perfectly straight line to bear upon another. They're kind of like gravity, which nobody really understands. Everyone can feel it. Like with music, anyone can hear a melody. Many people can describe it in general terms, predicting exactly what will happen, when and how, with considerable accuracy. These attributes of gravity's effect are the foundation of modern science. Yet still, the power of attraction which governs all bodies in the material universe is known only by what it does, not what it is. So I'll be describing them and attempting to predict the outcomes of events using the passages of their interactions like planets through the zodiac. But in reality, the truth is beyond us. Unless, of course, gravity is that quality of inexpressible truth that we call music, as differentiated from sounds. In which case, I shall be absurdly surprised to discover that there was truth in this prophecy." The transient wore no shoes, purposely. She reckoned this was part of her most necessary and appropriate homage to the native blood in her veins. That same blood which colored her cheeks quite unexpectedly when the manager of the coffee shop bumbled pretentiously to her defense. He was tall and young, at least too young to run for president, but clearly mature enough to be a congressman. The look in his eyes as he came to her defense showed more than sympathy and caffeine. It was perhaps even more than just appreciation of the exotic beauty of the girl. If one looked closely into his grin and bearing, mischievous defiance hid behind his affable propriety. One might guess that there was a backstory. He had, as the old Dusty Springfield song goes, been taking time to make time with the security guard, having known her and her ex-fiancé for most of his life. He now relished the opportunity to flirt with her, which had come about when the ex marked the fiancé. The petite, dark-haired security guard had come into Café Queequeg this morning. This was her daily ritual. Today, she complained of the cold, among other things.
"This uniform is going to drive me nuts. Short sleeves and polyester, ugh. In the morning, I'm so cold I get goosebumps,"
she said while watching the parking lot through the window.
"Maybe the smoker will warm you up,"
he replied softly, with a hint more depth of tone and warmth than he usually gave his patrons. He also held the cup up instead of setting it down, so that she was forced to look at him to get it. This she did with a quiet,
"Thanks."
As he reached out to set it down, he paused to begin a sentence.
"I've been thinking. We should get together for lunch after work." I think we both should get off at the same time.
She kept looking at him, feeling, as many would, the pregnancy of his offers.
We should both get off at the same time.
She repeated with tongue in cheek and eyebrow raised.
Why not? Lunch at 2:30?
She finished, but he wasn't done.
And a cigarette together at 11 to plot our purse.
He stated, turning now to look at the next customer coming in.
Sure, but don't get all mushy on me.
He laughed once with a closed mouth and said,
Mushy? No, not yet. You first.
At precisely 11, she met him at the employee exit door. As they exited, he admired the crisp lines and soft appearances of her neck and ear against the sunglasses, hat, and shirt she sported as part of her uniform. As he did, she was turning her head to notice and immediately begin reprimanding the transient.
Okay, so you're in a position of authority now. You can't just go acting aggressively from speculation. You gotta start with communication and work towards confirmation. First things first,
Ishmael said, between drags on his hand-rolled cigarette. That smoke, residual vaporous evidence of paper and dried organic matter rapidly oxidizing, causing reactions in the mind and physiology of those involved, has an inverse relationship to the symbolic value of these words. But this story isn't about you and me. Both ladies were now rolling cigarettes from his pouch. Maggie had left her menthols in her locker.
I'm no good at rolling, Ish. Could you?
She was looking down at the mangled wreck of an attempted roll-up. Self-loathing tainted her face. He guessed that it was over forgetfulness and manual ineptitude. Her reluctance to admit even that little failure in planning had set off Ishmael's insecuradar, his acute awareness of the neurotic tendencies that all people betray in their speech patterns and body language. He decided to begin pushing at the cracks in her armor.
No problem. My pleasure. Tobacco is for sharing, but please call me Ishmael.
The other girl with them snorted a little laugh. He smiled at her while rolling Maggie's smoke.
Novo,
he said, raising his eyebrows inquisitively. She smiled broadly in return, raising both for a brief fraction of a moment. Thus encouraged, he continued,
This might work for you, too. I used to work for Starbucks. Used the money from stock options and credit they helped me achieve to open a coffee shop of my own, here in the mall. I call it Cafe Peacock, CQs for short.
She let out a mouthful of smoke with that sensual effort that allows rings to form.
I thought they made you sign a non-competition agreement, intellectual property and all that jazz.
She said while watching him watch the smoke ring dissipate.
Oh, they did. I waited years before making my move. When I first opened, they opened another of their stores inside the mall here, too. Rent went up the next quarter. Some folks thought it was the end of me until their new push buttons alienated half their customers. Floated away on Freakwood's coffin.
He responded while appreciating that she had formed another large circle of white in the still air. Their table was protected by a concrete umbrella that some practical engineer had plopped on a pole that ran down into the table. It had been here before there ever was a Starbucks outside of Seattle. He watched Maggie's mixture of fascination and uneasiness as the transient sent another small ring to sit in the larger center, like a pupil within an iris. She made a funny face and rolled and looked at her cigarette. It had gone out. These things are
hard to keep lit, and they're pretty harsh.
The transient spoke up with,
American spirits are like that. Pure tobacco, an acquired taste, none of that artificial garbage that the big boys will push on you.
She gestured at the ashtray she'd been picking leftovers from at 11.
Thanks again, Ishmael, and you too, Maggie.
The other woman sat back quizzically.
For what?
For letting me stick around.
Maggie sniffed, sat erect in her spot, and relit her smoke.
Don't thank me. He's your patron saint.
She drawled through a mouthful of white wisps. All three fell silent for a moment. Ishmael chose that moment to make the aggressive statement he'd been composing in his head throughout the dialogue, reckoning that her response to this would tell him if they had a chance at real compatibility.
Okay, so you're in a position of authority now. You can't just go acting aggressively from speculation. You gotta start with communication and work towards confirmation. First things first.
He'd never before been anything but cordially platonic with her. She was great at that. They were healthy and well-employed. On paper, they were perfect, but it was in verbal and intellectual sparring that real attraction began for him. She inhaled sharply through her nose, flaring her nostrils and causing the cheap, silver-painted plastic badge on her chest to sparkle dramatically with reflected light. Her tone and choice of words then reflected his.
Okay, so that's interesting. I'll do my job the way I'm trained, Mr. Manager.
She took another drag.
These are harsh, but I kind of like it. Look, miss, what's your name?
Barefoot Bohemian Riot Girl replied.
Elemental PQRS TV.
Maggie rolled her eyes and made as if to stand. The girl quickly and coldly defended herself.
It really is. It's three different family names that my full-blooded Dinah mother harvested from my father's family tree.
Ishmael desperately attempted to reroute the conversation.
Dinah, Navajo, right? So sharing American spirits with you turns out to be something more than just a random act of generosity.
He said while turning meaningfully toward Maggie. She felt his drift and responded.
Okay, point taken. Ellie, can I ask you a question or two for the espresso jerk's benefit?
Sure, Margaret.
Came the transient's reply. The espresso jerk hit his chortle in a false cough, as if choking on a smoke.
Okay, so you're barefoot, heavily tattooed, wearing clothes that look like you rarely change them, and here you are re-rolling cigarette butts in an employees-only area. I speculated on seeing you that you were transient. Is that true?
LMNP took a sip from the travel mug she carried with her everywhere, wiped her mouth with the back of her hand, and said,
If by transient you mean homeless, no. This land is my land, and if by transient you mean constantly in motion, then yes, transient. Transient? I'm half immigrant, half native. My ancestors betrayed and warred with one another, but I own all of my own flesh and time. Truth is, I prefer the term refugee and sojourner.
Maggie stubbed out her smoke and half yawned.
And your purpose here is?
The girl looked down at her dirty bare feet.
I'm walking the Appalachian Trail right now, hitched into town to go dumpster diving.
Like some dramatic lawyer on the networks, Maggie stood and pronounced,
Well, that's another on my list. Part of my job is to keep this area clear of undesirables. Barefoot hitchhiking scavengers qualify immediately. I won't call the police and trespass you, but you can't do any of those things here. I've got to get back on the clock.
With that, she began walking, then turned.
And you, Mr. Ishmael, I will see you later.
She called with a smile as she donned her shades. He sat back and looked at the girl. She was rolling up the tobacco from a couple more snipes, including the remains of Maggie's. Smiling all the while, she hummed a little ditty.
Yo ho, yo ho. It's a pirate's life for me.
He sang along, having caught the tune. Immediately. Since they'd met, each had been quite amused, albeit separately. Now, for the first time, they laughed together. He then said what he thought was the nicest thing you could ever say to a woman you barely knew.
I feel like buying you some shoes, nuevos zapatos vamos.
Maggie's cigarette hadn't refreshed her as she had hoped. Not that anything was likely to have, as much as it normally would. Flirtation with Ishmael and jousting with that vagrant would normally have recharged her engines fully, like the deep breaths of a swimmer between the strokes of controlled violence that propelled her through time's waves. Today, first thing in the morning, the surf overtook her and nearly drowned her. She had gone under and been washed up on a metaphoric shore after the mad chaos. Inside, her head felt like she'd struggled against sands and currents on a battle she only won through surrender. To complete the metaphor badly, the coffee at dawn and smoke at lunch had been the compulsive paroxysms common to those who nearly drowned. Since the breakup of her long engagement, she'd been trying to reach the Mercy Shore by daily, mechanically working the clock and sparring jaw to jaw with anyone who'd engage with her. Ishmael had guessed well on which buttons to push, because such is conversational conflict for Maggie, the fuel with which she oxygenated the flame with which she beat back the cold and damp of common loneliness. The rogue wave that had struck her and had doused all hint of spark only work remained, with the exception of Ishmael's unexpected forwardness. That little bit of warmth from him perhaps began to compensate for the spattering of blood among scattered, shattered teeth that newly decorated the sidewalk and doors near the recycling bins at the maintenance entrance of the mall. When she found that, she hadn't even been in uniform yet. Before breakfast, before coffee even, a hazmat and law enforcement issue had sent her tumbling. Calling the police had been like the first underwater moment when one realizes that the tide is in control. Putting on her cheap copy of the crisp blue uniform and speaking to the real law had been surreal. The cops had been pleased. They already had the culprits in jail. The evidence she'd been assaulted by seemed important in piecing the story together. The three men in custody were in varying states of brokenness. However, like Jesus and the two guys they hung him with, only one is really important to this story. His name was Mike, but his handle is Nimrod. People only called him Mike when their purposes were official, familial, functionally formal, or unfriendly. When administrators, cops, or just generally fastidiously nosy folks insisted on knowing what his parents called him, he would respond,
"My dad calls me stupid, and my ma calls me sweetie, but they're both wrong. It's Nimrod."
The odd concentration of coincidences that make this story seem like it's worth telling all seem to involve him. For example, he and his pregnant girlfriend lived in Ishmael's garage. Above it, actually. But they paid for half of the garage as well. None of these three owned a car. But Ishmael kept this space open in case he had visitors who needed to use it. Nimrod operated a sort of political activist social club called the Info Shop out of the garage. It had one photocopier, two laptops, three printers, and a wireless router. Like the food on the Apollo rockets, it was a dehydrated anarchists collective. Just add liquid. Here's where the synchronicity began to strain credulity. Elemental P had spent the previous night there on the garage floor. Nimrod knew her as Canarchy Girl, a notoriously elusive percussionist, puppeteer, and provocateur in the Positive Protest Posse. When he wakes from the anesthesia, he will be in a hospital bed in the basement of the county courthouse. His jaw will be wired shut. The other two will be in much worse shape. In fact, only one will still be alive. Those two will be in beds across the room, 24 feet and two walls of wrought iron bars away. Nimrod will be able to hear the flatline beep of the dead man's monitor. In his heart and head, he'll fear the sound might be creating a gravitational pull that forges parallel lines in his relationship arc with his as-yet-unborn child.
"And never the twain shall meet,"
he'll mutter Shakespeareatorially. Once upon a time, he'd use the initial Q as his name. Those two found out why he'd been saddled with the handle Nimrod while serving as a Marine in Iraq. Whether in a combat zone declared by international custom or one hidden within the paranoid obscenity of the domestic war on drugs, Nimrod was a mighty hunter and warrior. Like his namesake in Moses' syncretism of the Egyptian, Hebrew, and Sumerian histories of Babylon, Nimrod did it all with strutting pomp and circumstance before the Lord. In the name of God, as proof of the wrath of the Son of Man, Nimrod was destruction. The military had trained him to act with the ruthless efficiency of extreme prejudice. He took it all a step further by reading up on samurai. Somewhere in the philosophical cocktail of a born-again crusader samurai, he thought he'd found a real solution to the big questions. This solution led to a dishonorable discharge. In the wild rush of the hunt, he went AWOL, chasing down attackers alone when he should have stood sentry. When he returned, having dispatched three enemy insurgents, he found the other four in his party dead. They'd done well taking out three enemies, but two remained to become remains at Nimrod's discretion. He was very discreet. Then he buried his two new trophies, reconnoitered the three decoys he'd already dispatched to bury as well, and waited for relief. When they found him, three days later, another insurgent had joined this American's democratically, they devoted with their violence, selected pile. Found culpable in his fellow's fate for abandoning his fort, he received no benefits or hope of pension from Uncle Sam. His mental martini of martial methodologies and messianic delusions was mixed twice, shaken by PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and stirred with marijuana swizzle stick. This habit he'd picked up from the Caucasian Rastafarians, who were prominent in Pyramus peace protests. This self-described agro-redneck peace punk Rastas with mullet dreadlocks hanging down on their dirty wife beaters and Carhartt overalls were prominent members of the local dumpster diving scene. The dead man's flat line will signal the nurse, cops, and doctors. They will bring to him paper and pen on a clipboard with which to write out his statement. It will speak for itself in his inimitable style of absurdly egotistic self-awareness, writing of himself in third person in all caps.
And it pleased the Lord to guide the hunter to the marketplace of Pyramus. The last crescent of the waning moon formed Diana's necklace, and the Milky Way her garment as she danced in the heavens with Orion. Nimrod found the Kaonarki girl, a Navajo, Kokopelli, come to sing redemption to the people of Pyramus, if they should care to listen. Nimrod found her beside the dumpster of Whole Food Grocery, eating organic blue corn chips while drinking lemonade. Yo-ho, he cried.
Aloha,
she replied. Gleaners, they saved food for a dozen meals and brought it to the storehouse of food, not bombs, in tribute. They clenched carrots in their fists and held them high. The Navajo woman was weary from 1,000 barefoot miles. He bid her recline on a cushion and went back to the gleaning on his bicycle. The Lord led Nimrod to a test of strength and character. Two servants of destruction, possessed by demons released by methamphetamines, lay ambush with wooden 2x4 planks. The hunter became the hunted. One blow to the mouth they delivered unsuspecting, knocking the warrior from his ride. A dozen others each double attempted, but Nimrod was untouchable. Dancing as a lion amongst jackals came some 100 yards. He navigated the crossroads beneath flashing amber and crimson lights. In the lot across the street where he had his face crushed with one fell blindside, he finally disarmed one of the two curs who doggedly nipped at his heels. Grasping the plank he'd ripped free, Nimrod delivered to each a blow to the neck in fluid motion of three turns, striking first the other plank on the fingers of his would-be assailant, knocking it free, then each opponent once to the place where neck met jaw. His blows had such force that each collapsed utterly. Taking up both planks, the hunter raised them to the sky in cruciform. When Nimrod knelt, placed the cross on the ground between the vanquished and wept.
Finishing, he wept again. A sheet now lay over the face of one of his assailants, the one with the mangled hand. He would never know that he had lost the use of his fingers, at least not in this flesh. Though unabashedly biblical in his life, Nimrod was among the unchurched. In fact, he saw himself as a force of social erosion, sent to bring down false churches and idolatry through dissemination of propaganda and collective reasoning. He lay back and thought about the teeth he'd lost, chuckled a gurgling chuckle, and sang through his shattered mouth,
Yo-ho-ho, we are the invisible pirates. It is better to stand alone than to stand with the enemy.
John Evan Bonhoeff awoke in the den of his father's McMansion. The book he'd fallen asleep reading, Herman Melville's Moby Dick, lay open, face on his lap, half-crumpled between his legs. His glasses lay on the table beside the chair. Before trying to find the spot where he'd drifted off in the book, he put on the spectacles. They corrected only for distance, but he felt more awake with them on. There it was, the Pequot at sea, Starbuck commanding Queequeg and Ishmael, brooding Ahab, colluding with the tortured elements of his soul to hunt down and destroy the ghosts, real and imagined, of his past. The book was a gift from the cafe owner, who bore its protagonist's name. To John, it marked an important passage in their relationship. That dynamic was far more important than the passage of the text he now marked with a flyer that had come with it for an event this afternoon. He looked at the rumpled paperback in his hand, then slapped it against his palm. Between the flyer and the fiction, he should be able to knock off a third, perhaps half, of the items on the list of things to do today, now taking form in his barely conscious, near-alpha state mind. After starting coffee brewing in the kitchen, he began his standard 6-item list on a piece of paper. It would remain with him in a shirt pocket all day. Yesterday's list had been written on the back of the paper of the bookmarking flyer. Number one, hallelujah. Number one never changed, yet for one simple word, it held for him a long and varied stream of meanings. They would change throughout the course of the day, though the syntax, text, and punctuation stayed the same. Number two, W-O-R-D, word, wept, W-E-P-T. Number two had been the same for some 18 months as he worked on a high-end book for technicians running the AV side of Christian worship services. He was stuck on some point, subconsciously caught in a crux that kept him from completing the careful construct. Number three, Ishmael. Three were frequently in flux. Three was frequently in flux, rarely, if ever, the same thing 2 days running, though often the same item appeared. Today he planned to get coffee at CQ and make a show of reading the book until Ishmael came to talk. The barista was a regular rhythm guitarist for the congregation's contemporary worship band. Not the world's best guitarist, but the secret line of credit behind the state-of-the-art equipment the Paramus Vineyard Christian Fellowship used, a most important relationship to cultivate. Number four, James, chapter 1, verse 27, food not bombs. Item 4 was always headed James chapter 1, verse 27, the injunction of the brother of Yeshua ben Yosef that true religion was to visit the widowed and the fatherless. Ishmael knew that number 4 on the daily list. He'd given him the flyer of For Food Not Bombs as a means of outreach facilitation. Apparently, this hippie sideshow soup kitchen in the park looked to Ish like a fertile mission field for the 127 fundamentals. Number 5, read the Bible. Number 5 never changed either. It may seem self-explanatory, but it has a deeper meaning. He found himself always wanting to read Scripture. It interfered with most of his other tasks. He wrote this item each day so that he could cross it out and thus by transference place an arbitrary and acceptable limit on how he buried his nose in the Jehovah's little instruction manual for life on earth. It was to him as intoxicants are for some others, an addiction. He attempted to manage his endless attraction to deification by making lists of other things he must first complete before he got biblical. The theory rarely regulated his bibliodolatrous obsession. 6. Find someone to kiss. This last one was why he hadn't finished a checklist in nearly 3 years. As a healthy, reasonable, and well-spoken young American, he was mystified by the lack of play in his game. He owned his own home, had paid his college debt down by half, and was actively involved as the sound engineer at his church. For such a man to go 33 months without a date was a typical travesty of the modern scene. Girls yearning for nice guys tend to share the same jerks as the good time girls did. He had come to kid himself recently that the passing of the 32nd month would mysteriously herald the thaw, that the ice formed over the stagnant pools of his hormones would crack and dissolve as his passions sprang vernally to life in the transition from month 32 from 32 months of monkishness to 33, preferably with a girl who liked Jesus too. His 6-item, 12-word list completed, John poured the coffee and pulled his cell phone from his pants pocket. It was nearly dead for having spent the night in his pants, leaving a small bruise on his thigh where he'd rolled over on it instead of on his father's electric bill. It would have to be plugged in before he could do anything else. It was already near the end of the lunch hour. He normally wasn't so nocturnal. The night had passed with intense cross-referencing of Jonah, Ahab, and their respective marine animals. Dawn had come homerically, rosy fingers tickling him to sleep while he read. He looked at his reflection in the refrigerator's chrome. This look of unshaven dishevelment was not a decent public face, so he factored in a shower to his already busy schedule. Canarchy Girl let herself back into the info shop through the second-floor apartment window by climbing a tree, dropping onto the roof, and swinging down the drainpipe to cling to the ledge of the window, which she had spotted as being slightly ajar from the ground.
Yo ho yo!
Herself as she broke into Nimrod's bathroom. The nice yuppie this morning had known the tune as well, in a present and singable sort of way. She hadn't asked him about it. If she had, he'd have mentioned the Pirate of Paramus, Nimrod, and she would have had to break. She wouldn't have had to break in. She presumed that he'd picked it up from the new pirate movie, where the guy plays his own dad. She'd been recently indoctrinated by Nimrod into his circle of invisible pirates. This theme song was... scheduled hour. It's 10:05 in the morning on the day after Memorial Day. This little story here we've told you is about all kinds of beautiful things. It was written by Henrietta Lawson. We are the Bad Folk Orchestra. My name is an invisible pirate. This here next to me is Timothy, who did the voice of Ishmael today. Canterkey Girl today was played by...
Caitlin.
Drew busted out for...
Nimrod.
Charlotte gave us the voices of both Maggie and... Henrietta Lawson. Henrietta Lawson being the author of all these stories that we're putting forth. Henrietta died a little while ago in my life, and she gave me these stories and asked me to distribute them, and that's what we're doing. This is all in the public record, and our engineer today is a man in the booth. I believe he likes to be called Dr. Uto Navigate. And this here is in the key.
And it was an engineering nightmare today. Thanks a lot for coming on Tuesday. On Tuesdays, you'll be hearing the wage slave hustle. And this is our theme song. Thanks a lot for Charlotte. Thanks you, Drewsome. Thank you, Caitlin. Thank you, Tim. And thank you, Invisible Pirate. Thank you, Owen. And thanks to all the veterans out there, dead and alive. You're listening to the Wave Slave Hustle, always on Tuesday afternoons.
While in Olympia, listen to KOWA Low Power 106.5 on your frequency modulation dial.